So, do you have to give tzedakah to every person who asks? No. Okay. What do you say when they come to your door and you don't have cash? You say, I can't right now. No, you don't have to tell them you don't have cash. You could just say, right now it doesn't work for us. I would add that the halacha assumes that there's a certain relationship between a husband and wife, and that there's a certain amount that we feel our, every husband wants his wife to feel comfortable spending, and there's a certain amount where the expectation within a marriage is that we talk about it before we spend that amount. It's interesting that husbands are bad at this, but Lemaisa, coming back to here, it's I'm saying very often the wife says, shouldn't we have discussed that before you spent that money on a new car or whatever? Okay, but bottom line, that the halacha does assume that before you're going to give a sizable amount, there's going to be a conversation. So, true story, about 20 years ago in California, there's a place called Hancock Park. So the Rav needed, he was fundraising for Kimcha de Pisa to buy the poor matzahs. So he went to one of his members' houses, and the wife answered the door. She said her husband's on a business trip. He said, "You know, we're trying to put together money to buy the poor matzahs. Is there something you could check with your husband? How much you should give?" So she says to him, "I'll just check what cash we have around the house, and whatever it is, I'll give you." And she comes back with $28,000. True story. So she says, "Here." So he didn't know what to do, right? You know, this was the cash they had lying around the house. So he took it and waited. And he did what the halacha says you're supposed to do. He called the husband and he said, "Look, you weren't around. So your wife gave me $28,000. Now that's not the amount you usually give for Kimcha de Pischa." And the husband was very nice. The husband said, "If that's what my wife gave, it's all going for tzedakah, use it." But that's halacha, that there's a certain amount, there's a range that every house has their range, that it's understandable between a husband and wife that the wife should do as she sees fit when people come to the door. What that range is has to be decided with each couple. If 28,000 wasn't the number, then it's clear to me that 5,000 in that house was the number. And if for $5,000 he didn't care. 28,000 was more than he expected. Okay, that's not what our houses run like. In our houses, you have to see what given your budget, what's acceptable between in the way you run the house. However, there are two aspects in tzedakah. One is, okay, there are multiple aspects. We'll start with one. If someone comes to us and it's pikuach nefesh, someone comes and says, "I'm hungry, I need to eat." So you bring them two slices of bread. It says that when there's room to think, there's pikuach nefesh, there you don't take the time to start checking, is the guy telling the truth? So many times I've had people stop me in the street and tell me I'm hungry. My kids are hungry at home. And I always say the same thing, "Come, we'll find the closest makolet, I'll buy you a loaf of bread." And they say, "No, my kids like this cereal and that cereal." Mm-hmm. And I say, no, I don't buy that for my kids. You want, your kids are hungry, I'll get you a loaf of bread." And except for once, every other time, the people just walked away. They never went with me to the makolet to get a loaf of bread. But I was fulfilling the halacha. The halacha says that if someone tells you they're hungry, so you can't assume you have the time to check out whether they're legitimate or not. So you get them food. But food, I've very often given them my sandwich, my lunch. Said, "You're hungry? Here, take my lunch." I don't have to give them money, but I can't ignore a person who tells me they're hungry with the assumption maybe he's a charlatan. However, when it comes to my money, so there I should really know where I'm giving tzedakah to. And this is where the halacha breaks down into two things. On the one hand, we're supposed to be giving people. And that's what the Rambam writes, that if you have an opportunity to give 100 times to 100 different people, that's better than giving one person 100 shekel. Because as we get accustomed to giving, we become giving people, and that's a good custom. On the other hand, you do want to have an impact with your tzedakah money. And this is a balancing act that every family has to figure out. The next question was asked, is it acceptable to make judgments on the cause? Everyone has to make judgments. We make judgments. However, the halacha has 24 levels of decision of how to give tzedakah. Your siblings come first, your own family, your own relatives, your own neighbors. A person who doesn't have what to eat comes before a person who needs money to buy himself a Cadillac. Meaning there are different levels in tzedakah, and it's one of the shaylos that come up every month. It's highly recommended you sit down with the Rav and figure out how you want to allocate your tzedakah. A person once came that he had a large sum of money that he wanted to give to tzedakah. And I said to him, do you have relatives who need it? So he thought for a minute and he said, no. I said, does your wife have relatives who need it? So he looks at me and says, they're my relatives too. We have a responsibility to our family first. So and people sometimes run to get tzedakah and they don't calculate, do they have enough money put aside? Is it right for them to give tzedakah? What about the money they might need if their child needs a root canal or a child needs orthotics or all kinds of needs that our own children, our own family might need? Before a person runs out and invests their tzedakah, it's a good idea to sit down and go over the halachot, because sometimes a person would be more wise to calculate their tzedakah differently. Should everyone give ma'aser? Yeah. How do you calculate ma'aser? That's a very good question. There are many angles as to how we calculate ma'aser. Is it pre-expenses or post-expenses? Is the money you use for your children included in your tzedakah money or not? So there are many angles to be discussed. And that's why it's recommended that people do allocate the money and also sit down with the Rav and figure out what's the proper way to spend their tzedakah money.
A question on the side, because I go with it with the family comes first. What is in the case of when you are Georgian, that your not Jewish parents count as family or not?
Degree, yes. Now, Halacha says, but again, it's recommended to sit down and figure it out with the Rav. But the part of Hilchos Tzedakah is that we give Tzedakah also to non-Jews together with Jews. How much? Mm-hmm. How it should be decided? I had a student once who was a priest. And when he converted to Judaism, his children did not. His wife and children did not. And we would sit together and write Christmas cards. What could he write and what can't he write? But he had to write. I always told him, your kids are expecting that. So you won't mention what's against the Torah, but you will give them encouragement. You will speak to them about being decent human beings and taking on New Year's pledges. And we would write his Christmas cards together. We would pick the gifts together. It's a good idea to figure out, again, how much and in what venue. Mm-hmm. Does soap need a hechsher? No. Need a hechsher? No. Do disposable dishes need a hechsher? No. What if I use them with boiling hot soup and the soup might melt the bowls a little bit? That's okay. We assume that nothing positive came into your soup and that's fine. The only exception when chad pa'ami, when disposable items need a hechsher, is paper goods on Pesach. Paper goods on Pesach sometimes have starch on them. So for Pesach, it's a good idea that everything should have a hechsher, but really what really needs it are the paper goods. Can I put soap in a pot and heat up the pot? Yes. Can I pour boiling water into a soapy pot? Yes. Our assumption is that even if the soap does not have a hechsher, no positive non-kosher flavor goes from that soap to your pot. So you don't have to worry. If the way you're going to clean your pot is by boiling it with soap and soapy water and whatever, that's fine. If you want to pour in boiling water on your soap, that's also fine. Can I listen to Jewish music with psukim while cleaning the bathroom? So this is interesting. Shuls have their bathrooms within earshot of the shul. So when you go to the bathroom, you could hear Kriyas HaTorah, you could hear Kaddish, and you have to make sure you're not answering Yehi Shmei Rabba in there, right? You're not allowed to say holy things in a bathroom. So hearing things is not usser. Saying things and thinking things of holiness is usser. Meaning that the isser is for me to think psukim. Now, if while you're cleaning the bathroom, you're going to listen to a song with psukim, and you're going to end up saying those words, then that's not a good idea. Thinking the psukim, I doubt anyone thinks about psukim as they hear the music. But saying the words of the pasuk, that's aser. I'm not allowed to do that in a bathroom. So technically, it's mutter. If I have music playing in the background, just like next to a shul, people go to the bathroom and they hear what's going on in the shul, that's okay. So too, if I hear music and they're singing psukim, that's okay. What's not okay is to say the words of Pesukim or to think the words of Pesukim. I'm not allowed to think Torah in a bathroom. I'm not allowed to say Torah or brachos or davening or whatever in a bathroom.
How can you be in the bathroom hearing Kaddish hearing Shema or something without thinking of the
film? So that's up to a person to control their thoughts.
Don't go to the bathroom in just time.
That's what the Mishnah Brura says. Do your the Mishnah Brura writes. Do your counting. Or read a secular book.
In the shul.
Okay. Look, but it's a reality. Most shuls don't put their bathrooms far enough away that you don't hear it. I'm saying there's a reality.
How could you not think the words that you're hearing?
Think about something else.
Right.
Try to think about something else, and you think what you should not say.
It's a consolation for anyone. The doors to the bathroom in Ashkenazi shul are very heavy.
Yes.
It's extremely heavy.
You don't hear it.
My chocolate children's fingers lost, to be careful. But you're not
so you don't hear it. In Ashkenazi shul, you don't hear it.
Yeah. Okay, if there is a smell of a dirty diaper, so ideally we don't say blessings next to that. If you did, then your blessings are fine. Your kiddush is okay, your benching is okay. What if there's a smell of a dirty diaper, but there is no dirty diaper? Probably one of the older kids isn't clean. What are my limitations? Really none. I'm saying it's no different. If you know anything is going on, fine. But otherwise, we assume that there isn't anything around. If you know one of the older kids had an accident, then it's the same. It's the same as a diaper, really. If we touched on this, let's touch on one other thing that people sometimes overlook, and that is that when a woman's hair is uncovered, then you cannot make blessings. So sometimes comes Havdalah time, just like that there are two things written in the pasuk. One is the area has to be clean, which is there shouldn't be feces or urine in the place where we make blessings or daven. So that's relevant to us when we daven in our kids with diapers. Then in the same area in Parshas Kiseitze, the Torah discusses the idea that that a person shouldn't be uncovered. It includes a man or a woman shouldn't be uncovered at a time that things of holiness are taking place. So when we daven or make blessings, there's a certain amount of modesty that must be in our area, in our machane, in the place that we see. So if a woman wants to make a bracha or daven and she's wearing a robe. So if there's anything under the robe, that's fine. But there has to be a separation between the heart and a person's private parts. What happens if a person's hair is uncovered, a woman's hair is uncovered? So the custom is that we cover our hair even in the house. But it's a custom, meaning technically if a woman, for whatever reason, is right now without her hair covering in the house, it's only her and her husband or whatever, he can't make Havdalah. This is where it comes up in many houses, that sometimes the wife hasn't covered her hair yet, and the husband is ready for Havdalah, so he can't make Havdalah with her, even though she's his wife, and even though right now they're mutar. Mm-hmm. So that's something that people sometimes overlook. Yeah.
If you are davening and you start Shemona Esrei, and the diaper is good when you start,
right,
and then it becomes not good, what's your best option?
And the kid is next to you.
Of course the kid's next to you, your dad.
So the kid is wearing a garment other than the diaper, or just the diaper?
Usually.
No, okay. If there's a difference, I'll explain. If there's a garment, so then you could choose what works for you. Because there are shittos that say that if it's covered, so then even though you can smell it, you can daven. L'chatchila, we don't rely on that, but you're in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. However, if they're not wearing a garment, it's almost always there's a little bit that's like really on the surface of the diaper, right? And there it would be more appropriate to stop your davening, not talk, but stop, clean the diaper, clean your hands, and go back to Shemoneh Esrei. Just remember that there is an opinion that walking without talking is not a hefsek. So we would rely on that opinion. It's a machlokas Shulchan Aruch and Kra in Shulchan Aruch. And here we would rely on that opinion. But you could kiss the child. I'm saying we don't have to be gruff. We just shouldn't talk. If we don't have to, we should really not talk and change the diaper, clean our hands, and go back to Shemoneh Esrei. The next question was, can someone wrap their hands instead of washing for bread? So the halacha describes the following. The halacha says you're traveling and you don't have water easily accessible. How far do you have to go to get water in order to wash, to eat the bread? So the halacha says two things. You have to walk 18 minutes in the wrong direction. That means, let's say you're sitting in your house here, and the water stops in Kochav Yaakov. 18 minutes would get you to the edge of Tel Tzion, I think, or an 18-minute walk. So the halacha expects you to leave your house and go all the way there, if you know there's water there, to wash your hands, and then come back and eat your bread. And if it's a longer distance, now, this is a gauge of tircha. How much do I have to work to obtain water and wash my hands? So you'll say, I'm on an 18-hour flight, and there's no water right now to wash my hands. Well, in 5 minutes will you have water? In 10 minutes will you have water? This is a gauge of tircha. How much do I have to invest in order to obtain water? So the concept is 18 minutes out of your way, which is really 36 minutes. It's 18 minutes there and 18 minutes back. And even then, it would only be permissible if you're really hungry. Meaning, then a person is allowed to wrap their hands and eat the bread. What I'm saying now is in Shulchan Aruch. It's not no big chiddush. It's in the laws of washing hands. We know the story of Rabbi Akiva. He was an old man. He was in prison. His Talmud brought him water to drink, and he had water to wash his hands. And the jailer decided there was too much water, so he spilled half the water out. So when he brought the water to Rabbi Akiva, he saw Rabbi Akiva washing his hands before he ate the bread. So he said, Rabbi, your life depends on this water. He says, yeah, and I'm chayav misa if I eat the bread without washing. So I'm going to wash my hands, and I'm not going to forgo what Chazal instituted to wash hands before eating bread. So we're not Rabbi Akiva, but the halacha still says that before we use this leniency of wearing gloves, of wrapping our hands instead of washing for bread, the halacha says it has to be two things. A tircha, that's the equivalent of 18 minutes in the wrong direction, which is again 36 minutes. It's 18 minutes there and 18 minutes back, and you have to be really hungry. So sometimes you are, right? There are certain scenarios where you are. Sometimes a woman just gives birth, she's sitting in the hospital bed, she's been in labor for 2 days, she hasn't had anything to eat, and she's not supposed to get out of bed, and she's ravenous. Okay, she thinks to herself, is this equal? If I had to, I'd walk 18 minutes there and 18 minutes back, I am that hungry, that's how I feel. Fine, put on the gloves, make a hamotzi, and enjoy the food. The halacha relies on the person to call that shot. The concept the halacha gives us is that's the level of tircha we have to invest in order to wash before we eat. If I have chicken in the frying pan, am I allowed to pour oil onto the frying pan? So it goes like this. If things are hot, I have hot chicken, I have hot oil, I'm not supposed to pour directly from the bottle because I'm concerned that the steam will come up, I'm concerned things will splash. I'm not supposed to pour directly onto hot fleishik from my cold bottle. And it doesn't matter if I'm pouring onto the chicken or I'm pouring onto the oil that's by the chicken or I'm pouring into the hot chulent. I don't pour directly from a parv vessel with oil or with water for that matter. If I want to put more water in my chulent pot, I'm not supposed to pour directly into the hot chulent pot from my parv vessel. What about if I have one of these fancy frying pans that have no oil? So then I'm allowed to pour, even though it's a fleishik frying pan, I'm allowed to pour from my oil onto the pan, so long as I'm not pouring on the chicken. So if I have schnitzel on one side, and I want to add oil for whatever reason, and I'm going to pour my oil on an area of the pan which is dry, so that's okay. So I don't pour on hot fleishiks. Okay.
Does that also apply to spices?
Technically, we should put the spices on a spoon or in our hand, and the idea is that the steam comes up into the spices. Yeah, people, the same thing with salt. That's why we try to have a fleishik milchik and a parv salt shaker, because the steam goes up into the salt. You're making soup,
why do you put it that way? Don't pour from the parv or oil container, rather than say, have a fleishik soil and a milchik soil.
Because most people don't have enough room in their cabinet for both. Practically,
you
it doesn't
have two
work.
Kitchens. Don't speak here with us, okay?
Saying, realistically, so what people can do is put it in a cup and pour from the cup inside. Pour it on a spoon and pour it from the spoon inside. But to pour directly once it's hot is a problem. there are two questions here which are important. And can children under the age of bar and bas mitzvah sift flour, tovel dishes, check eggs, check dried fruits, check rice? Okay, so we'll start with sifting flour. The general concept is that children under bar and bat mitzvah, maybe we'll start with what's relevant to them. If a child wants to eat a date, most dates don't have worms, and they're very easy to check. So the halacha trusts a kid when it's something that they can do, they know how to do, and it's not a tircha. Meaning, that's when the halacha trusts a child. So checking a date isn't a big deal. You open the date, you look, you put it up to the sun, they could see, okay. So a child can be trusted to eat his own dates.
From what age?
From the age that you believe them, they know how to do it, and that they will. From the age that it makes sense to you, that they will. Now, what about sifting flour? So our flour, unless you're buying in the natural stores, if you're buying it at our makolet, where there's a high turnover, most of our flour is bug-free. If you know your flour has bugs, then the child can't check it. If you're buying regular flour, again, from a regular store that has a high turnover, so then most of the time the flour is really without worms or bugs. So then, if you're next to the child, and you've taught them how to do it, even if you're in and out of the room, they can do it, so long as they know you're overseeing them, and so long as they're sifting, and at the end of sifting, they don't do this. Right? Because then you didn't accomplish anything. If you know that your kid isn't going to do this at the end, or every so often, so you have to make sure you trust the child and that it makes sense. So then, the child should know that they're only doing it with you present. You don't want a situation where they're going to end up making cookies. Hi, Ma, I surprised you. Make cookies for everyone. There has to be, in the child's chinuch, they have to know, I do it when Abba and Ima are next. I mean, the same is true as checking eggs. Our eggs, again, if you're not buying natural eggs, when you're buying natural eggs, then you have to check. Because on natural eggs, you don't know if there are male chickens around the female chickens. On the eggs you buy from Tnuva, the eggs you buy at a store, so our eggs, we check, and we have to check, and if we find blood, we're not allowed to eat it, but it's much more lenient. Because our eggs are from chickens that really grow out without males. So if you have your daughter or son standing next to you, and you've taught them how to check eggs, and you see that they generally know what they're doing, you could let them check eggs next to you. That's okay. So we covered sifting flour, assuming you don't know of the flour being different. We covered checking eggs. Again, when you're next to them, and they know you're overseeing what they did. And any food that is the same status, that there isn't a chazaka, you don't have to assume that food is wormy, and it's easy to check. Those are going to be our two criteria. If it's a tircha, so it says in the halachos of Pesach, we can't count on kids to check for chametz, because it's hard work checking for chametz. So we don't rely on the kids for checking for chametz.
But they have four bar mitzvah, they can't, then the day after they could.
That's the cutoff point, yeah. In terms of checking rice, if you're next to them and they know what they're doing, so then they can do that. A mother wants to comb her girls' hair on Shabbat, so we need two criteria. Number one, we need a brush that won't tear her hairs. That they sell in the stores what's called Mivreshet Seyar, a comb that's made of some animal's hair that, I don't want to tell you which animal, but it doesn't tear her hair. And it should be designated as a Shabbos brush. Now, Halacha says, combing hair with a regular brush is uvdan dechol. It's a weekday type activity. So if you're going to do it on Shabbos, do it with something that's designated for Shabbos. Now, the question is, should we stop here or continue another 5 minutes? Yeah? Do we have questions? Should we recap or move forward?
Forward?
Children, so long as an adult is present, so long as you're overseeing the child do it.
And they make the vow?
Yeah. Things that are publicized in the newspaper, are we allowed to tell them over? Did you hear what they wrote about whoever? So the Chafetz Chaim breaks down Lashon Hara into two things. The one is what we know. We're not allowed to say something that would harm someone else. We're not allowed to speak and say something that's going to harm someone else. That's the obvious one. But the Chafetz Chaim adds another point. And he says, that when we say something with evil intent, when there's really nothing positive, there's no good reason why we're saying it, so we're saying it to publicize it, we're saying it to put someone down, you might term it as, whenever the Yetzer Hara is involved, so then it's Aser. Meaning the only time we'd be allowed to say something about someone just because it's in the paper is when I have good intentions. The Chafetz Chaim adds the second component, he proves it from the Rambam in the Halacha of Apeit Lasa, that I'm not allowed to say something when my intention is evil. And that's part of our nature, that we do want to say negative about people. It makes us feel better, we put someone else down, however you'll explain it. So I can't have the intention of spreading bad about someone, I can't have the intention of harming someone, I can't have any bad intentions. And that's why what they say in the yeshivas is, after you learn Chafetz Chaim, there's not much Lashon Hara you could say, right? Even the leniencies are not such leniencies. There are times where it's mutar. There are times that you want to tell someone about a certain store. There was an electronic store in Givat Shaul that forged their heksha, their kashrut l'shabbat. Really, their refrigerators did not have the thing that makes it that on Shabbos they don't act, and they just forged the heksha. So there, you might want to tell your neighbor, hey, you know, if you're going to buy electronics, and I hear you're looking over there, you should know that there, your point, again, when your intention is to warn someone of something, if it's for good intention, you want to ensure someone doesn't get burnt, so there, we could say, if it's already been advertised in the newspaper that the store was caught, I could tell other people because my intention is positive. There is another heter called Ma'is Amcha, if someone doesn't behave like a Jew. I don't know if we should be looking for the kulos in that. There's a bug in a house over Shabbos. How do I get rid of it? I cannot put a cup over it. That's called tzad. You captured it. What you could do is use a broom and sweep it out. You could also put it in a vessel where it's not caught, right? We had this big, it's not a centipede, with a lot of feet that ran very fast that came into the house. Now, if you put it in a big bucket or in a big box where you still can't catch it, and then you toss it out, that's okay. The idea of a broom is that it's kila achar yad. I'm not directly moving the bug. It has to be that I don't think I'm going to kill it. You know, you bash a spider, you know you're going to kill it with the broom. So long as you're not confident you're going to kill it, you could move it out of the house with a broom. Chemical heating pad. So the halacha discusses a chemical called seed, which was cold, but when it came into contact with hot things, it would become hot. And that's Aser on Shabbos. And that's why we're not sure which chemicals are included in the prohibition that the Gemara spoke about in seed. And that's why we don't use chemical heat, meaning that they had a pachit alohetet, they had this cup that had two chemicals. You turn it, and then it would reach 95 degrees. It would heat up your coffee. So we don't do that on Shabbos. The last point, which I'm not going to go into this time, we'll go into next time, is old parents. When it comes to pikuach nefesh, so people sometimes analyze Shabbos incorrectly. And there are two points I want people to remember. Number one, when a person reaches a certain age, so almost everything is pikuach nefesh. People shouldn't be so quick to say, well, it's only A or it's only B. If under normal circumstances you would think to take this person to the hospital, don't be so quick to say it's okay. In pikuach nefesh, when there's room to doubt, when there's room to think maybe it's pikuach nefesh, it's pikuach nefesh. And the second point that people forget is blood pressure. Sometimes a person's in pain and people say it's only A or it's only B. And it's not only A or B because you have to factor what that does to the person's blood pressure. I've had numerous times this comes up. I speak about it in shul almost every month because almost every month a shaila comes up where people did not respond correctly, where there were situations that people should have called an ambulance on Shabbos, and this happens almost every month. People, Baruch Hashem, are very careful about Shabbos. We also have to remember that when there's room to think there's pikuach nefesh involved, you don't have to be the world's biggest doctor. You have to have room to think there's a danger, and then you have to act. And a person, the level of where it came to, it shouldn't get there. And again, every month we run into this. I don't think there's a month I don't talk about it in shul. And every time I talk about it, it's because I get burnt again. It's another story, another situation that happened on Shabbos where people did not go to the hospital and they should have. And when people pass a certain age, people are by their 90s, you have to realize that small things are big things. I would end with one simple point. When parents reach a certain age, for simple things, take them to the emergency room because you want the blood work done. We've had too many instances where people thought it was just a little thing, and even the doctors thought it was a little thing. Had they gone to the emergency room and had the blood work done, then they would have realized that it's something more serious. When people pass a certain threshold of an age, so I tell people, at this age, you don't fast on Yom Kippur without asking your doctor. I don't care that you feel well and your medical case is right. I want to hear from your doctor you're okay. And past a certain age, when medical issues come up, you get serious care. You don't take it lightly. The same is relevant to Shabbos. If you feel that this might be dangerous, if you feel, hey, the person's in serious pain, so serious pain at a certain age becomes pikuach nefesh. And also, remember to factor the blood pressure. Blood pressure isn't a joke, and people forget it. People think, they look at a medical scene, and they say, it's only A. Remember to ask yourself where the blood pressure is holding. So we covered Baruch Hashem a lot. Yishar Koach, all the questions were interesting. And we'll see if people have more questions, because we covered almost everything by now. So we'll see if people have more questions if we'll meet again. Yeah, say that. Say that.